The Geekatorium 27-hour podcast challenge on FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back to FUBAR Radio's Geekatorium's Comic Relief's Charity 27 event.
You're going to say it right.
No, I don't want to now. Now I'm in a rut. Now I need to mangle that language as much as I can get. Hello, if you're new to this hour, I lost track. It's 3 a.m. in the morning.
Oh, yeah.
We've just been speaking to a wrestler, and my life has changed forever.
I think you, if it came to a war of words, you won that battle.
Did you broach the whole subject of it being made up and pretending to be sport?
Well, we talk about the narrative of it, which is effectively the same thing. Because it is.
He was nice, wasn't he? He was good. I liked him.
It sounded very charming.
In fact, what I've understood from, you know, interviews with wrestlers and things I've heard on like podcasts and stuff is that it's the nice wrestlers who are nasty and the nasty ones who actually come across as the nicest. Yeah. And I get the impression that they're like soap actor stars where they go out onto the street and, "You're nasty, Nick!" "No, my name's Steve and I hit a big man with muscles for money."
I like that he was saying, well, you said, did you do a sort of killer move to finish the fight? He went, "Yeah, I smashed his face."
Dropped him on his head.
Yeah. Stupid head, I think it was.
Yeah. Stupid head.
I'd like to dispute, though, that sense of, you know, the nice the bad guys being nice off out of the ring.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I once saw Giant Haystacks.
This isn't going to be a terrible
school
story, is it?
No. I just saw him in Woolworths, and because he was in town to, because I used to go to the wrestling when I was at university, and he was wandering around Woolworths, and he was indeed giant. I mean, he was enormous, and you kind of looked at him, and if he caught your eye, either he was really carrying, but he thought, "I'm really not going to go up to this guy and say, 'Oh, hello, giant. I mean, you're really friendly.'" Because he just thought he would have just torn your head off, you know.
He was an intimidating figure.
You'd just climbed to the top of a beanstalk when you when you saw him.
He must have died of a heart attack, mustn't he?
Oh, God, happy times.
No, I'm serious. He was huge.
He was enormous,
He must have.
As far as I remember, he was wearing some kind of, it did have the appearance of like an animal skin.
He was like a peasant type thing, wasn't it? It was like a brown.
He was like something that, yeah. He was like a caveman.
Wrestling was wrestling, and men were men.
Shirley Crabtree.
Yeah.
That was Big Daddy,
Yeah, that's right.
Because that was for me growing up. My weekends, I'd be dropped off at my nan's and my granddad would watch the wrestling.
Yeah, I thought your granddad was Big Daddy.
No. He might have looked a bit like him from an angle, but no, it was like that and then Grandstand. And then, you know, in the afternoon, Bullseye.
Grandstand?
Yeah.
Oh, Grandstand. Sorry.
I thought you said Grandstand.
Well, there's also that.
She's just standing there.
It was a horrible quiz show, I'll give you that.
It's 3 a.m.
An old lady on one leg balancing until she fell over to win a car.
Grandstand.
There's only a Renault 5.
It's like Touch the Truck, yeah. Grandstand. How long can this 87-year-old woman stand on one leg? Can she win a Peugeot 206?
A lot of illegal betting in Thailand on that one.
It's ruined the game for me. I don't believe Brenda from Sudbury.
She's not 87. She's 60. They've got makeup. They've wrinkled her.
Fix. Can I just? I know. I'm pulling us back off that flow. But I just got this up on Wikipedia about Giant Haystacks. Have a guess at his size, his height.
Again, 6'2".
Anyone?
No, I'd go with that.
6'7".
6'11".
No way!
So what are you, 6'2"?
6'1".
6'1", so...
Yeah, he was big.
Wow. He was big.
Tell me what you reckon he weighed, his fighting weight.
30 stone.
I have no concept of weight.
48 stone.
Are you sure that's not Big Daddy?
13 pounds.
That is... Let's be fair to him. He is a Big Daddy.
That's
Haystack. Oh, well, he was a big one of those as well.
But you Daddy wasn't as big.
I'll tell you,
he
wasn't as big.
He
just
was
Haystack.
Mobile, though. Because I actually saw him fight once, and he was just, it was like, a bit like King Kong up the, you know, on the top of the Empire State with all these planes flying around. He's like, oh, God. And just pick one up, and, you know, he just got. But this guy he was fighting, who was looking really, you know, a really, really athletic, in fantastic shape, and you know, next to any of us would have looked like an intimidatingly large figure, and he did. He looked like a small child, and he was trying to fight John Haystacks, and just basically picked it. I know it was partly staged, but every so often, if you saw a full evening bout, you'd see something, you'd think that was put in That was put in nastily, and the guy was not expecting it. You know, and he just picked somebody up and threw him against a ring post or something.
Because I don't know what the difference between British wrestling. Oh, is this the gentleman?
Is this EC3?
Let's see EC3.
Oh,
I'll say this. Dashing.
Yeah, he's a good looking guy.
He was talking about, you know, not being.
Yeah, I don't look at him and think villain. He looks lovely. No, he's got a nice smile.
Well, you don't know what the
never trust a man who shaves his chest that smoothly.
Well, that goes back to Graham on the phone again, I think.
Maybe the heart of his evil is that he doesn't shave his chest, but sort of, you know, forces, I don't know, small children or something
to nibble it,
or animals to nibble it off. Yeah.
Oh, because back in the day, I mean, especially in WWF at the time, they'd have, you know, like pins in the tarpaulin on the wrestling ring, or little razors that they'd hide. So when they had a bash, they'd cut themselves.
Really?
And they'd cut themselves to give themselves
Genuine cuts?
Yeah. And pins on the side that you could just stab.
No, I'm not interested in that. Not for me.
But they cleaned all that out, because when that went from WF to WE, it all became family friendly, because they were selling video games and T-shirts and all this kind of stuff. So, no blood. You'll see the most aggressive violence, but because there's no blood...
They really cut themselves?
Yeah.
God, that's a dark world.
I know. It's almost like it's like wrestling meets Breaking Bad. It's just lots of people cutting themselves.
There was a lot of drug use.
That was when the emos were the best at wrestling.
Boom! Got it out there. Yeah, I've never been one for wrestling, but it's like Power Rangers. Wrestling and Power Rangers has just been a constant pop culture thing, and it, you know, you see WrestleMania, and it's packed with Americans. There you go. I'll do that one, Don.
It's all done. Paul's having a breakdown.
It's 3:10, everyone.
I just had a moment.
Did you?
Yeah. Well done.
What was that?
Just a moment of existential sort of angst.
Did you leave your own body there briefly?
Yeah.
I thought that you, because you levitated briefly. And then
I just sort of saw the task ahead and.
And you saw it. You got a sort of perspective.
Yeah. Was it like the total perspective vortex?
Outside myself.
Yes.
What am I doing?
Yeah. He says you are here.
Break it down. You just got to break it down into
manageable bite-sized
chunks.
Break
it down into 10-hour sections.
Digestible 10-hour sections.
That's true. Not only for a 27-hour podcast challenge, but for life
and lovemaking.
Yeah. Indeed. Yeah, I'm trying to...
Lovemaking.
I'm trying to break it down into the 10-hour session.
That's right. It's,
just so you can get through it.
I taught Sting everything he knows.
You know what? We were talking about this in one of our podcasts a while ago, but, like, Sting didn't want to give his son any of his inheritance. Because he didn't want to spoil them. Yeah, and they had to work for their money.
Yeah.
And I think it was you that said... Because of the tantric sex thing, that kid deserved money for the length of time it took for him to be developed and pushed out.
Yeah, it gave him £1 a year for 27 years. That's how he gave it to him. Tantric money giving.
Tantric payments.
Yeah. tantric inheritance.
Yeah.
You know, the kid's crawled out his cock at fucking 0.2 miles an hour. You know, he's taken a long time to even get where he is.
Yeah.
And then... Sting, I'd be like so pissed off.
Thanks, Dal. I love you. Thanks for giving me the gold filter to gold.
Oh, I don't know. I think he's got the right attitude there.
No, you're right. I just think.
Mind you, if you're the kid, maybe you'd. No, you need that kind of privilege knocked out of you, I think. You know.
Well, that's fair enough, I guess.
You know.
Yeah, I just have.
You know, but you want to be supportive. I mean, he's not going to let him starve, is he?
Who knows?
We just don't know what Sting's like. He's all peace and love, but you know.
Is he starving?
He's got
children,
values, you know.
Yeah, you know, he's probably got the old.
Bill Gates did the same thing, didn't he?
Well, he was never in the police.
No,
Bill Gates was never in the police.
I don't believe Bill Gates wrote songs.
He wasn't in June, or was it? No, he wasn't. Bill Gates wasn't in June, was he?
No, he was in Wings.
Was it Wings?
Just for a little bit. And then, got kicked out after Pipes of Peace, and there was a bit of a culture clash.
He did not get on with Paul McCartney.
No, no one gets on with Paul McCartney.
Allegedly.
No, I don't know. I'm making it all up so I can say allegedly.
Meat Free Mondays. Do you remember when he did that? That was a good video, wasn't it, when he did that? I think that's Paul McCartney's best song.
Meat Free Mondays.
He sang this song in a sort of mock Jamaican accent where he goes, Meat Free Mondays.
Sorry, are you confusing Paul McCartney with Mike Reed, UKIP reggae
no,
song?
No, honestly, I'll tell you what, in the next break, YouTube, it is one of the most
I mean, how to destroy
Well, he's got previous with mock reggae, doesn't he? Obla di, obla da.
Oh, yeah.
This is what.
No, that's where reggae started.
Oh, he invented reggae.
Yeah.
Oh,
right. Yeah, not many people know that, but I was around at the time, and I can attest.
I mean, it's a good thing that he's doing Meat Free Mondays, but he destroys the good by doing it in a reggae style.
Well, he could put anyone off vegetarianism, couldn't he? Really?
Well, no. You'd have to have a proper irrational hatred of Paul McCartney to just go, that you and your Meat Free Mondays.
That does happen.
Well, yeah, as we're discovering. From him.
Yeah, Eli is now eating double the meat.
Just for you, Paul.
Ooh. Oh, go on, do you, Paul McCartney?
There
you go. Spot on.
Look, it's late.
Oh, it's very late. I'm only now beginning to feel the...
Well, you've just drank a litre of energy drink, haven't
I'm
you?
I'm on my third.
Passed that out. That one's been passed out over the first few hours. That one's going to make last the next few. I've got coffees and cigarettes.
I bought bananas.
Yeah, I'm going to do the banana.
Can we talk about something which is completely irrelevant, but I just want to get it done. This bloody thing about the dress that's either black or blue.
It's white.
Or golden.
It's golden white.
They've
sent another picture out.
I don't get what this story's about.
Ewan was explaining it to me, your producer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ewan, come in here, because I don't get what's coming in, so you need to...
I could show you what happens.
Yeah, get Bent, we got
no,
Nick
get
here.
In right. No, you can't get him in. But no, basically what it is, it's something to do with the background. And when you perceive colour, the cones that perceive the different colours sort of react at different... At different speeds.
Okay.
This is probably not entirely accurate, but it's a rough principle. And according to what the background is, the first sort of splash of colour that your eye perceives will make it assume that the other colours that are perceiving it are closer to the first colour it perceives. So according to where, I guess it must be, you know, according to what your cones are like. From person to person, what you perceive, what colour you perceive first, then affects the in the background.
Your perception
then affects your perception of what the colours are in the main image. Is that roughly?
No,
right?
He was giving the thumbs up, so I'm presuming.
Is that roughly right? Yeah.
If it's passed the science test. Because I mean, the thing is, we live in an age now where the internet puts something online, and for a while, because we trusted the internet, we're like, that's a fact. But when I see stories like that, I go, am I about to be made an idiot by me liking this or saying, you know... I feel like there's always a catch to things you see on the internet.
I love those things where it's, you know, something... You see something, and then it just before it goes viral, so you kind of go, oh, yeah, look at this thing, and then all of a sudden everyone's talking about it, and then everyone starts joking about, oh, look at these idiots who are talking about this thing. And it's like, oh, I've already done it. I've talked about it at the beginning, and now I look like an idiot.
I've set the trend.
Like, anyone, imagine if you got caught out and you did an ice bucket challenge before I hated everyone that did one. Imagine if I'd seen it and gone, oh, that's a good idea. I'm going to do one, and then realised how terrible it was.
The thing is, the Ice Bucket Challenge was a great way to raise awareness for this charity.
Easy for you to say.
But all the videos show were all the people shirking donating money.
Yeah, yeah,
and
that's
that was
true.
The thing.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not giving money, splosh, you're
yes.
And I just found that counterproductive.
Yeah, it was awful. It was. That's exactly what it was. It's a charity thing where if you don't... Oh, no, do you give money anyway?
No.
No, the idea was that was the forfeit for not doing
it. You either give money or you cover yourself in ice water. Or if you're Justin Bieber, you don't do either. And you say you did both.
Is that what
That's
happened?
That's literally what he did. He was like, oh, I've given money. No, Justin, we found out you haven't. Oh, I've got a bucket of water. Drip, dribble, oh, I've done it. No, Justin, you've not done it. Do it properly.
He's only young.
He's too young for an ice bucket challenge.
I don't often have strong opinions on the pop world, but Justin Bieber can eat a big bag of dicks. It's because it's behaviour. I get we live in a, you know, rock star behaviour, rock and roll, yeah, sex, drugs and alcohol. Give me that with Black Sabbath. Don't give me that with a man who looks like a girl who looks like a boy. Saying baby, baby, baby. I don't want...
I've never heard a Justin Bieber song.
I think they're basically just him saying baby,
oh,
baby,
yeah.
baby.
They're just ambient. Just if you walked into Topshop or something, you would have heard
it. Is Justin Bieber like the first music that will pass into you via osmosis? Like you just... Everyone is just absorbing him all the time.
Well, I don't know any of his songs. He He exists as a paradox.
Strong opinions on a man, then.
It's just because, this is the thing, I don't know him for his music, I know him for his behaviour, and his behaviour is disgusting. And so why do I care about
his
music?
Weren't the Beatles disgusting in 1960?
Well, it was well known John Lennon wasn't a very particularly nice man to certain women in his life. That was the most delicate way I could put it.
But, so, what's worse, Justin Bieber gobbing on some people, or John Lennon
beating his wife?
Yeah. I didn't say that.
I know you didn't. I did. I took.
No, it's all Beatles bashing moment here.
Well,
you got Paul.
I'm not bashing the Beatles. That is not what I'm doing. I'm just saying, can you like an artist outside of their behaviour?
Of course.
Because, of course.
That's
but
a good
then
question.
The question is, can I listen to Gary Glitter songs and still enjoy them?
At this point, I'm going to mention
still.
Well, yes.
At this point, I'm going to mention the
just gone down
the concept of redemption.
Talk about redemption. I love this theory.
Oh, yes. So, redemption.
So, if an artist is so amazingly good and is a genius,
yeah,
and then it turns out that they beat their wife, they've redeemed themselves.
By having a back catalogue that...
So it's sort of like an insurance policy, you're saying?
Yeah.
You're saying that, the artistic motive is covering up and atoning for your bad behaviour.
Well, I'm not saying it's not in my view, but I'm saying in society it's a bit like that, isn't it?
Definitely true.
It's a bit like that, isn't it? Because, like, for example, let's say, look at Michael Jackson and Gary Glitter.
Let's.
Who's more redeemed? I think Michael Jackson redeemed himself.
Well, let's be honest.
So what we're talking about here is a separation between artistic, the creation of an artistic object and the creator of that object.
Personally, that's what I think.
So this,
I think the work isn't the person.
Absolutely.
So it happens, you know, it may happen. I may love a novel, and then I hear that the author was a huge Nazi. It doesn't matter. It's still a great novel. You know.
Well, it depends. I don't know. I mean, you know, depends on the novel. But you know.
But I don't think I don't think you should dismiss work.
Of course not.
Just because of the person who
it happens in every. It's not just music or like even in sport. Like, I'm a football fan. Like Diego Maradona, who did the Hand of God in 1986. He is hated. Like that would cheat. English people hate him. Thierry Henry a few years ago handballed it for France against Ireland, and they went through to the World Cup, and Ireland went out. He is a legend. Thierry Henry is loved by people, and that is because it was like, oh yeah, no, we like him, but we don't like Diego Maradona because he was just a cokehead and blah blah blah. And it, so it is. You're right. I think people, if people like you, they just go, oh, he's a little tinker, isn't he? He did that thing.
It's politics.
Yeah,
it's politics, isn't it?
Definitely. That's
but
true.
Do we pick and choose what crimes we can put under the mat?
I think there's a very good case that it depends up from person to person, the amount of charm.
Totally agree.
For want of a better word.
Boris Johnson.
Oh. Let's talk about Mr.
Boris Johnson. When he got elected last time, I'd have conversations with people, and they'd go, oh, he's so
cuddly.
I don't care, I'm going to vote for him. I don't care. Literally, I just think he's funny, I'm going to vote for him.
He'll get votes for that. He's because he's a little bit funny and
what?
Yeah, he scruffs his hair up. he must be good. No, he still stands against everything that most people should believe.
It's
a very studied creation of an eccentric persona, isn't it?
I wonder how much of it is genuine and how much is like an act.
It's that insidious idea that because they're lovable goofs, they can't actually make proper harm.
Where does the line go, though? Is there, like, ever going to be, like, just a man, like, oh, he's done a bit of embezzling, but he's a lovely guy. He's a real funny guy. Oh, he killed all those people, but, oh, God, he was funny, wasn't he?
Like, example of that is Chopper.
He's
let's be honest, a horrible, horrible human being who is now transferred to a lovable rogue who killed...
Even Bronson. He's held up like a hero. He's
nasty.
And I don't even like the Death Wish movies, you know?
But, I mean, he's regarded really, really highly. And if anyone else did it, you'd say it was abhorrent. Or in this country, like, if it was, like, you know, a foreigner in this country, it would be... Can you imagine the outcries? Like, and we're paying for this guy to be in prison blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But with him, it's like, he's the most dangerous man in the world. Yeah. What a hero.
You project... What I think what people do in that situation is project some part... their own desires, fantasies onto that person, don't they? As
and
well.
Also when they become slightly mythologized, you know, that sense of the stories are so big that they almost seem unreal, so you can you can give yourself moralistic distance from the crime because it seems outlandish.
But even it's 3 a.m, so I can't remember. The guy that went on the rampage,
Raoul Moat,
and he was he murdered people, he shot people, and people were like, the public were going, "Oh, I hope he gets away." It's like, what are you talking
about?
It's
that kind of, it's that kind of outlaw. The mythologising and the glamorisation.
So where does it change, though? Where does it change from mad gunman on the run to a lovable rogue who shot some people in the face? When does that become... It's completely unacceptable. I don't understand where the line...
I think it's when the hype
It's distance
disappears.
As well, isn't it? It's distance from... It's distance from your own reality. Like, if you, you know, you heard about... I mean, you know, I don't know. History can do it, or pure physical distance can do it. Just change the perception. Even if it's... how much of a joke you can make about some kind of disaster or whatever, time and physical distance as well.
But isn't it amazing how quickly it can happen? Like that happened within a couple of days, and the whole country is kind of, not the whole country, but there's a big group of people. And it's like the riots, when the riots happened, and that went, the whole country took it on and was like, there was kids smashing stuff up.
Well, I was going to say, the other side of it is the identification, for better or worse, you know, the fact that, you know, people clearly in some way identified with Raoul Moat, whether for whatever reason. But I think with the riots, it was much clearer case of there's a lot of simmering resentment and anger and sense of disenfranchisement that every so often will, you know, one spark will...
I just find it amazing how quickly, across the country, different pockets of the country just went bang, and the same thing was happening.
And I think clearly, you know, part of it was opportunism, but I think probably part of it was, you know, for that opportunism to express itself as rioting and looting, you know, you the conditions must have created those that propensity in the people in the first place, and that's, you know,
it's weird. It's also I find personally a problem that we now like to, let me get this phrase right because I'm probably not going to it this time, but the idea of creating a narrative to reality. So like, you've got, for example, Oliver Stone about to make a film about the who's the name of the guy who won that Oscar for the documentary Chapter 4? What else? Do you know?
Edward Snowden.
Snowden. Oh, yeah. So he's going to make a movie about that. As far as I'm concerned, that's still now.
Happening.
How can you have the distance to step back and...
Well, I think you throw up a very good question, which is, you know, creating a narrative of life. We do it all the time. Mm. On every level. I mean, you know, when you really sit down to think about it, the division between fact and fiction is very, very hard to make. I don't know, you know, the fictional assumption that, you know, of using the future tense, I will go to the supermarket tomorrow morning unless, you know, a meteorite falls out of the sky and smashes me. You know, all the things that could happen to us, we fictionalise that impossibility. We know that the odds are low, but we fictionalise the chances of them happening. Or she wouldn't get out of bed in the morning if you thought, well, this could happen, that could happen. You know, the way we interpret everything is it's always from imperfect knowledge. So we're putting together an idea of it from what people tell us, opinions we get from friends or from media, or our own perceptions of it. So that it's a very blurred line between, you know, I haven't even had a spliff. I'm saying what is reality and what is the opposite of reality. But then again, the opposite of reality becomes part of reality. So reality is its own opposite. So like, categorization of things becomes
things.
Like, you know, when you put too much paper in the end of a spliff, then it all sort of turns to little clouds of ash just floating up into the air before you get any of the weed into your lungs. Don't try this at home, children. It's like reality is like that. It's like ash.
It's like you.
Yeah, that is me.
What is ash? What is the Rizla paper?
Hope. Well, slowly burning away. Right, let's take a quick...
It's nearly half past three, though. Yeah.
Let's take a little quick break, and we'll be right back after these words and messages.
Fubar Radio presents the Geekatorium 27-hour podcast challenge, raising money for comic relief. Donate now by going to my.rednoseday.com/sponsor/Geekatorium27podcast. Fubar and Geekatorium, doing something stupid for a very good cause.
It's three for the deal. That's not a great comeback from the song.
Should I try it?
Yeah, go on, you do it.
It's 3:30. We're back. 27 hours long podcast, comic relief,
and
other
that
stuff.
Was a 20th Century Coyote, or as we like to know, Rick Mayall and Aid Edmondson doing the... I believe it was released as a single, I'm Evil.
No, it wasn't.
No, it was released as a single.
I own it on 7-inch.
So it was released as a single.
It's the B-side.
Isn't that a B-side? What's the A-side to that?
It wasn't a single by itself.
Was it Alexi Sayles?
No, it wouldn't have been.
No. Because it was the comic strip off the comic strip album, wasn't it? I would have thought that would have been an A-side. And the B-side, I thought, was his Oh Gosh, I'm So Lonely. La, 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 that one. But we're never going to find
that. I wish I could remember, because I own it.
You know what? We have the internet.
Yeah, but that's no one wants to hear us tapping away.
Tapping away on keys.
I'll tap away on keys. Was...
from what we were talking about before, I don't know, I couldn't really think of a way to shoehorn it in, but... There's that cognitive fallacy, which is well known, which people have difficulty... The example they give is that Hitler loved children, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. People can't deal with that. Mm. They can't understand how someone can be both things.
Yeah.
You know? Like loving and also a murderer.
I think there's certain probably categories of children that he would not have put into that category.
No.
But yeah, I know. I take your point. I think it's... yeah. Well, nobody's perfect.
Nobody's perfect.
Hey, give Hitler a break. Nobody's perfect.
Stop raining on Hitler's parade.
And he wasn't a vegetarian. I just want to speak as a vegetarian. That's not true.
No one ever asked you to defend your vegetarianism via Hitler.
But I'm just saying, everyone goes, oh, Hitler was a vegetarian. He wasn't. That's not true.
Apparently...
Wasn't even German.
There's a
wasn't even Nazi.
Have you seen the website?
Never killed a man.
Have you seen that website?
What, Hitler...
No, vegetarians are evil. Should check it out.
Oh, yes, we did that on the podcast.
That's brilliant, man. Attila the Hun
was a vegetarian.
Apparently.
well, no.
There are no bad vegetarians.
No, I can't think of any.
Thank you very
much.
But
then I only know two. Linda McCartney and Paul McCartney.
And me.
And Ash Frith.
What
great company you're in.
Linda, Paul.
Ash.
Ash.
I was veggie.
I was veggie for a while as well.
No, until I was 10.
Yeah, because you went to a weird school.
Because you breastfed until you were 10. You're not allowed to eat.
The horrible
else.
Thing was his own breasts.
Eli breastfeeding on himself.
Yeah. That's why I've got such long nipples. I have to tap them behind me.
He's totally self-sufficient.
See, the reason I went vegetarian from like the age of, I think it was 15 to 24, 25.
I thought you were only 21 now.
Look at you. I love you. Give us a cuddle. And it was simply because at school, all the meat we were served was rancid, horrible, you know, horrible burgers. I've never in my life, until I left school, had a burger with an air bubble in it.
Oh,
you know, when
God.
You just got that weird bobble of it, and it was just horrible, and it put me off. And my mum said, oh, well, you're vegetarian now, I bought you that special vegetarian meat. She never bought special vegetarian.
What?
So the first year of my vegetarianism, what my mum would do is she would serve the family, you know, here's spaghetti bolognese, wait 10 minutes, and then serve me mine and say, there's your special one.
And again, we're back to perception and reality.
She's done that thing where...
She's worse than Hitler, my mother, that's what I'm saying.
By giving birth to you, she has sort of done her good, so all that bad, she's like, I can do these terrible things to Paul because
I brought him into being.
Yeah, she redeemed herself by forcing you out of her.
Yeah, and the don't say it like that, like it was against her will. Like the whole 9 months.
I was late.
Yeah, I was early. I was 6 weeks early. I had the umbilical cord wrapped around my neck.
What, like a set of headphones as you're wearing now?
More like the noose I would wear in later life.
For predestined.
Yeah.
Tell me, how did you react when you found out that the special vegetarian meat was actually bits of dead animal at a slightly different temperature from the rest of your family.
Yeah, I don't think I found that out till years later. I think it was one of those things where my mum said, you know what I used to do when you were impressionable and full of hope and the life ahead of you? I would ruin your ideal dreams of being a vegetarian.
Well, it's a good thing you weren't really utterly committed to it. Because you would have been a lot angrier, probably.
I went veggie when I was 11, so it's like 24 years now.
And what caused you to go?
What caused me to go?
What broke your will on eating meat?
Just the whole death, cruelty thing. I just couldn't get my head around it.
Did you watch Pandora's Lunchbox?
No.
You know what it is, though? It's a documentary about, like, abattoirs.
That might have been what it was, but yeah. I left home. I think I was 20 or 21 when I moved out. Literally the day after I moved out, Mum was like, oh, and I've been... Because she went vegetarian with me at the same time. Like, she was supporting me.
Yeah.
And I moved out, and she was like, oh, just so you know, I've just started eating meat again. And then it dawned on me that she'd just been eating meat the entire time, hadn't she? It was like, you know, in Gavin and Stacey, where the mum is, like, pretending to be vegetarian. That's what she must have been doing. You don't go from being vegetarian for, like, 10 years to then just licking meat off ribs. You know? Oh, yeah, I've completely given up all of my preconceived ideas, just scoffing bargain buckets, pulling meat off the bone.
I still can't do that. Even though I eat meat now, I can't eat anything off the bone. Ribs, chops, chicken bones.
That's problematic, isn't it?
Why? What of?
You've got to be able to reach out and kill it.
Yeah.
But then no one is, though. That is.
I'd kill things. I would kill it and eat it.
How hard is it to kill a bag of Doritos, out of interest?
Actually, look in front of Eli now. He has got a delicious feast in front of him of healthy snacks.
Apples, bananas, and minstrels.
No, honestly, I'm fully prepared to kill my meat.
You heard it here first, everybody.
Eli, I wouldn't
Silverman.
Want to kill a pet. I wouldn't want to kill a nice dog.
Oh, that's good of you, Eli. That is good. You've done well. I don't want to kill the dog, but I have.
I'm hungry.
So, yeah, but I mean, well, that's another weird thing as well, isn't it? Like how it's not acceptable to eat a dog, but it is acceptable to eat a cow.
That's just all bullshit.
That's very much a cultural thing because, you know, I wouldn't say stereotype, but you know the kind of the negative connotation that China eat dogs and cats. Yeah. But like that was because it was very poor and the only meat they can get hold of was the stray dogs and cats.
But
in the area.
But what is the difference? Just because we've domesticated them.
It's because we domesticated them.
Yeah.
That's why. And everyone.
But then people eat rabbit. And that's domesticated.
Yeah, but rabbits are just weird, aren't they? Just scary. With their twitchy noses and their funny floppy ears staring me out. Have you seen those?
Staring you out?
Yeah, they stare you out. You know, they're sniffing. Have you seen those?
Is that the sound of a rabbit staring you out?
Yeah.
That's the baleful eye of a rabbit. That's not an audio clip.
I'm trying to get the audio of the stare.
Sound effect. Different sniffs of a rabbit, and that's.
But you've seen those pictures of those giant rabbits that they
breed. They don't really exist, Eli. That's just. That was just a film. That was Night of the Lupus.
Night of the Lupus. Is that real?
Lupus.
I think it's lupus.
Lupus is wolf. Lepus is rabbit.
To the internet.
Yeah. You know the king of the rabbits, you know who that is, don't you?
No.
Frith.
Frith.
Yeah, that's me.
It's an old sort of pagan thing.
It's a Celtic.
Celtic, yeah.
Yeah, so that's me. I'm
Knight of the Lepus.
Lepus,
however you want to say it.
And I always remember what happens is somebody pours some nuclear waste down a drain or something outside. I think it's in Australia.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And they've had one of those scenes where. To give you loads of exposition where the woman is really stupid and of course has to ask all these scientific questions of the scientist men as well, Laura, it's like this, you see the
radiation's mutated the growth gene in the rabbit.
So this gets poured down and it goes into the rabbit holes and you get these huge rabbits. But have you seen the film?
Not recently, no.
Well, the fantastic thing is that the way they make the rabbits look big is just by getting an ordinary rabbit and like getting the camera just really, really low on it. And it's obviously just
foreground
a real rabbit being
where
filmed
have those
from
films
an odd
gone?
Angle.
They were so good. You know when people were being attacked by a giant crab and it was just they had a crab on the lens.
Yeah, shoving it with a stick from a spider.
The film starred Janet Leigh, Psychofilm, and DeForest Kelly.
Mm.
And Rory Calhoun.
That's a funny name, DeForest Kelly.
Yeah, it really is.
Andy, though, is Kelly.
I'm trying. My brain isn't comedically working, it turns out, because there should be a joke with DeForest Kelly.
Yeah, I know. There's several there. I think you can just leave it for the listeners to unpack, really.
DeForest Kelly? No, I just...
Exactly.
So when he died, I tried. When he died, could you say that was deforestation?
No.
You could indeed say that because it's a free country. And I respect your courage as well as your right.
All right, fair enough.
I like those science fiction films where they're smoking on spaceships. That's always great. They're walking around, you know. Because in the fag on
in the 60s and 70s when they didn't realise that wouldn't be the thing that happened,
it's not appropriate.
Yeah, of course he's doing. And there's like an android that smokes.
Yeah. I think what ruined the magic of those films were when special effects improved.
Yeah,
because there's always that charm to obviously the low angles, the kind of perceptive thing.
You had to make it up with the music, didn't you?
They're just getting an iguana and stick a horn on it.
Yeah.
I just listened to a podcast. There's a podcast called Stuff You Should Know, which is brilliant. They've just done the films that changed movie history, and they talk about 2001 Space Odyssey, mm-hmm. and they talk about how, you know, I think that came after Star Wars, I think, didn't
no,
it?
No, it was seven years before.
And then so George Lucas said, like, well, they've done it, so nothing we ever do will be as good as that, so anything else is just like a pretender to that. But I didn't realise that with that film, you know, there's no dialogue for 30 minutes at the beginning or end of that film. It's fantastic.
Oh, 2001, But that's because you could make a film like that.
If
you were Kubrick, you could make that film. Yeah. And get, you know.
But they just completely changed that genre. Like the shots of it, the way it was filmed was completely. And like you say, it's like.
I mean, our generation's version of that is probably Jurassic Park. Because there was a line drawn in the sand between like animatronic Harryhausen kind of, you know, the way that. And then suddenly, all of a sudden, the CGI developed to. Make these dinosaurs
in 2001
work.
You know, they gave him like apparently they sort of showed him what the aliens could be like, and he was like, let's not do this, we can't show them because they won't be good enough, so they didn't show them, which is an amazing bit. Imagine just going, you know what, we're going to do Radio. Something completely different, we're not showing them.
That's what makes it so brilliant. And you know, the other film that had a similar sort of thing happened was Jaws.
Yeah, when it broke, didn't it?
The shark didn't work, so they couldn't show the shark.
Oh,
so,
is that right?
They had a nightmare making that film. Like, the shark didn't work, everything, it went over budget, nothing happened. And that's what led it to it being fantastically suspenseful.
And
having that whole scene, which they improvise, where they're all telling the story in the boat, which is like one of the best scenes ever in film.
It is. It really is an incredible scene, isn't it?
And there's a modern version of that, to a certain extent. Have you seen Attack the Block, the Jack Cornish film?
Yeah.
So that alludes to the aliens for ages and ages without you actually seeing them. And then when you do see them, they're just like dark, shadowy masses. And it's done really, really well. It's actually, I think, a fairly low-budget film, comparatively. But they do it brilliantly. Like, the suspense is there. You don't see it until quite near the end of the film. And when you do see it, it is just a dark shadow.
Well, we live in a time now where cinema is spectacle and pretty much nothing else. So when you can make robots transform into cars and you can make aliens and all this space travel, it's like Jeff Goldblum says, just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Yeah,
and that's why things like Alien works, because you don't see the alien. It's abstract.
All the suspense
images.
Is gone. All the suspense is gone.
Yeah. And,
you can just
And it's a weird lost art now, to the point where when people. Or someone makes a horror film and you don't see the monster until the last 25 minutes, everyone thinks that's revolutionary. It's like, no, that's how you should make it. My favourite horror film of all time is Robert Wise's The Haunting, and it's still one of my favourite top five films of all time.
Have you ever seen... Sorry, I was just going to say, I'll just throw this in as a
go on.
Scary horror film, is The Night of the Hunter.
Yes.
Not technically.
Lawton.
Charles, the only film that Charles Lawton directed, Robert Mitchum, is it? And he plays this mad preacher who's trying to track down these kids who have the secret of where this money is hidden. He was in a cell with their father who'd done a bank robbery out of necessity, and it's just him trying to track them down, and it's absolutely terrifying. I think it was all shot in a studio.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
and the scenes like he's relentlessly tracking them down the Mississippi. And there's one scene where they're hiding in a barn and he's in the distance riding this horse, and you just see him silhouetted against the horizon. And the way that they got the perspective was to have a midget on a donkey. You know, yeah. It's and again, the reason I rambled onto that point is that, you know, it's making a virtue out of necessity in terms of limited resources and so on, but just with the sense of what the purpose and the effect is that you want to create, and that it's in the mind and the tone rather than just in the, you know, in the technology.
It lets the audience develop that character and lets imagine.
Yeah, exactly. And the image is just, it's, whoa, once you see this, it's terrible. I mean, it doesn't look like it, you know, it looks real.
It's for its time, it's an aggressively dark film.
Very dark.
You know, because you got these two kids who are very vulnerable, they've had a horrible, you know, almost Dickensian upbringing, and they're haunted relentlessly by this despicable human being. And it gets to points where, I can't remember now, it's been a long time, but there's an allusion towards molestation, I believe, in one scene where he approaches. Yeah. I might be remembering it wrong.
No, there's a whole thing where he sort of flirts
with that girl. Yeah,
that's
girl.
Right.
Yeah. But the reason why, again, I love The Haunting so much is that that's a ghost story that, even when you get to the very end, you can't guarantee the hauntings aren't in the mind of the main protagonist. You can walk away from that film and think that house wasn't haunted at all, or you can go, that is the most terrifying house in the world. And there's one of the best examples is a beautiful shot in that film where the two female characters, mine's gone blank, Eleanor is one, and the other one was played by, again, brain goes blank, so I'm going to stop. But basically they're in a room, and next door, which is the room which is empty, they start hearing mumbling, and it's a male voice. And then it's very stern, it's like, blah, 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 blah. And then you hear a kind of child's voice, obviously sad and upset. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't see what's in the next room, you don't see a ghost. All that film does is for like 2-3 minutes, it holds on the wallpaper of the room they're in.
Ugh.
And the wallpaper is designed in such a way that you could almost see a face in it.
Uh-huh.
So the longer it holds the shot, the more you see the face and the more the sound.
And it's basically resonating in you rather than you seeing anything directly.
I mean, the best way to describe, you know, the difference between suggesting and seeing is like, if you read Lovecraft enjoys the fact that what he describes is undescribable. He's very much a kind of, you won't believe the horror where he saw tentacles and teeth, and it's unimaginable. But then when it's realised, it's basically just a squid with an anger issue.
Yeah.
You know, it's always just this kind of thing. And it's like, that's why it's very hard to make a Lovecraft movie, because it's all suggestion, it's all unsurmountable madness and horror and things that you cannot unsee.
Yeah, you should never see that. That's the prime example of it. You should never see those monsters because the whole idea of it is like, you can barely fathom how horrific this is.
Yeah.
It's like when, like, you know, Godzilla, that the latest one, it's like, he's so huge, this Godzilla, and so you shouldn't show it because then he's not as big. He's not as big as I can imagine him to be.
Yeah, exactly. It's that room for imagination. You know, we were talking earlier about the interpretation of jokes, and I wonder if there's a connection really in the sense of how the more everything is four square on a screen, the less appeals to the imagination, the less the imagination and critical faculties have to be employed. Whether, you know, to whatever, maybe your critical faculties are being exploited when you know the imagination is being used to create horror, but we're complicit in that exploitation.
Yeah.
But it also kind of opens you out to makes you more open to more interpretations, and rather than having a very literal. Once your imagination is shrunk.
Yes.
Then your reality is shrunk as well.
So I wonder whether, because in comedy, you'll have different people getting it at different points. So if you're alluding something, and you'll get, like, if you're heading towards a punchline, halfway there, if you've got a room of 100 people, 10 people will get it. Three quarters of that, and it builds up, so people get falling in. I wonder if that's the same with film, if you've got these kind of, you're alluding to things, whether people are all observing it differently, or whether it's...
It goes back to that dress. Really, when you think about it.
For fuck's sake.
You know, it does. There is the analogy that comedy and horror work on very, very similar parameters, in that they're both about exploring something you're familiar with, making you comfortable with that thought, and then subverting it at the end for either a fright or a laugh.
Yeah, it's true.
And the best comedy horrors are the ones that don't trivialise the horror, but exaggerate the humorous reaction to that horror.
Yeah.
So you look at things like, you know, Ghostbusters, Gremlins, Evil Dead 2, American Werewolf in London.
They're proper horror films with proper humor films tagged on.
With the humor coming from our reaction to it. And
which again, you know, we were talking about, you know, the moral interpretation of crime or, you know, and the difference between a comic ghost or horror story and a straightforward horror one is again part of it is a matter of distance and perspective, you know, between our relationship with the characters and their relationship to the phenomena that they're dealing with. You know, it's that question of distance comes into it that creates different aesthetic effects or different generic effects.
And this is why I was always confused by the popularity of, like, the torture porn films that were popular in the early 2000s, you know, like Hostel and those kind of films. I mean...
I had no idea.
It was an interesting subgenre.
There was a few, wasn't there, where it was just... Yeah, I don't know who's watching that.
Well... That is exactly my question, because there's legitimate films. Tension. Hostel. I mean, I don't like these films. I don't enjoy a film that's only attractive, you know, thing is that you'll see someone tortured for the longest time in graphic detail.
Right.
But I will say this, the ones that do it right have some kind of message. I don't like Hostel that much, but there is a proper message in that film about the way America sees Europe.
Don't go to Europe.
Well, there was that. There was that whole sense of that, but there's also the way about how Americans see the world and how that is subverted and how they're punished with that knowledge, which is all based on the kind of the classic ideas of horror that was examined in Cabin in the Woods. You know, you have your types and tropes and familiar.
I've heard great things about it, actually.
It's a great film. I mean, if you don't like horror, you'll love it. And if you love horror, you'll adore it.
Yeah.
It's love letter to the horror fans. And it's a nice stab in the back if you don't like the genre that much. And obviously, it's written by Joss Whedon, so you can't go wrong. But, the problem with the torture porn stuff for me was its only trait was how gory can we make it. And was that a reaction, do you think, to... I mean, I don't want to make this too highfalutin, but the idea of, you know, after 9/11, there was a sense of this injustice, and so a lot of it was worked out through action films and horror films and things like that. I mean, I remember...
Quite an interestingly simplistic reaction to it as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
And again, it's, you know, talking about relationship between reality and perception and so on, and to sort of break it down into simple elements like that is It's reflecting the animus and the gut reaction.
Well, it becomes
without really analysing the the reality of it in any responsible way, perhaps.
But then it becomes this idea where you use
cathartic.
Yeah, you work it refuge, out really. With that distance and unreality of it. But what I don't get and what I don't like is when they use real life atrocities to do a shortcut to, like, an emotional point. Like, the greatest example I can think of is there was some bloody awful film with Robert Pattinson in where he plays a wayward youth whose dad, played by Pierce Brosnan, doesn't get him, and he's, even though he's mega rich, he's awkward and he falls in love and his life starts correcting itself after years of being dodgy. And the final shot of that film is Pierce Brosnan giving his son the job of his future to sort his life out, and he's in his office and he goes, "This is the start of a new day," and the camera pans out and you see the office he's in is the World Trade Center a couple of days before 9/11, and you think,
God, that's,
oh fuck, that's off it's like, oh, he changed his ways, but he's definitely going to die in a few days time. And it was just like,
oh my god,
and
all that potential just destroyed.
It goes back to that, how soon can we use those?
No, I don't think it comes back to how soon. In that case, I just think it's a very, very cheap and trite execution of the idea. But I think if you had something with some kind of, you know, narrative or moral integrity, you could do it straight away. It's just a question of what you're saying and how you're saying it, rather than the thing in itself. That would be my argument.
And that's what it goes back, weirdly, bringing up, you know, like Oliver Stone again, is that he made JFK, and JFK has no foot in reality in terms of, you know, the conspiracy theories. It's a great, it's a great, silly conspiracy story that Americans hold dear. And that had the benefit of what? 30 years distance, so you could take license with it. But then he makes the 9/11 film, which came out, I don't think, that long after the event.
That long.
And again, it's that, why can you tell that story? I mean, obviously you can, because you can look at the Titanic as an example.
I see what you mean, yeah. Yes. Well, it, you know, or look at Shakespearean history plays where you're looking at an essence of, you know, the character and a certain amount of, you know, you might be looking at the kingship in depth, but there'll be distortion of the historical facts because of the fact that he was writing under a Tudor dynasty and all those kind of things, blah, blah, blah. But, yeah, something like 9/11, that close to it is, again, it's sort of, I don't know, it seems to me that I'm leaping ahead in my because it's 4 a.m. But to my mind, conspiracy theories to a certain extent are a comfort blanket for in that
that's definitely the case.
They create a consistent vision of the world. It might be a frightening one and one that ascribes everything to blames everything on malevolent forces or whatever. But perversely, I think there's a sense of comfort because it makes some kind of
someone sense. Is doing something. Someone is in control, even if they're doing negative things.
Yeah, and I think that this leaps into my mind at the moment. You know, and I don't want to go down this route too much because I don't think it's the right kind of.
And also, we've got 3 minutes till.
Oh,
the next
okay.
Time,
let's leave it. That, let's that's good. That's great.
We can jump back into that afterwards because it's good to have the conversation. I just hate being there. Interesting point, and now I've got to go.
Did you notice that he started talking about conspiracy theories?
And then he gets cut off.
And then goes, "Oh, we're coming up to the news."
It's all the same, isn't it?
I'm so part of the Illuminati, my friend.
I've always known it. I could see it in your eyes.
No, I mean,
he's a Zionist leprechaun, mate. He's
got
a
fucking chip implanted in his brain.
You know what? It was only
Paul Agenda Gannon.
Thank you. I'd like to think of myself as a the manipulator of truth.
Oh.
And that mostly
is that your wrestling name?
Yeah, it is.
We've got to come up with wrestling
names. Alistair Campbell.
But I think after 4 o'clock, we'll get into conspiracy theories a bit more, because it's an interesting topic in terms of what we learn, what we think, and the reality of it. So
I think you think we will, but I'm not sure we ever will.
See, now I don't know how to react to that statement. Oh, good. I really panicked then. I was hearing that and you weren't saying it. Because we are at that point now where we're only 8 hours in. Mate.
No, you've got to stop doing that.
All right, I've got to stop doing that.
8 hours in!
Yay!
Oh, no, only another 19 to go.
And there it's gone again. Just like sand in my hands, whittling away. Oh, God.
No, you're doing great. Honestly, I come in, and like I said, I wasn't entirely sure where to sort of pitch my excitement levels. Because I didn't want to be the arsehole that come in and was like, "Hey, everybody!"
No, we need that arsehole.
You guys seem to be doing okay. Eli, as I say, that shuts down and, off lines.
I've got Red Bull belly.
Oh, God. Eli's had an accident. No, but you're actually doing well. I mean, Richard perked up as he was leaving, I'll be honest. But
He looked quite happy, didn't he, when he knew that he could open
the
door.
Exactly, he had the
escape route planned. I wanted to ask him, is his beard hipster or jihadi? Because
he will err on jihadi every time.
You get that wrong.
His beard
was saying depending on how tanned his skin is, depends on how he gets stopped at the airport.
He gets stopped.
Yeah,
he is just straight down the line English white guy. Mm. But I mean, he's a casting director's dream.
Yeah. He is. Yeah,
he's John Rhys Davies of our generation.
Yeah.
I don't know who that is.
No,
he was the guy who was in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
He could do because Richard does those adverts, couldn't he? His next advert could be, "I love jihadis."
And we've ruined it.
FUBAR Radio presents the Geekatorium 27-hour podcast challenge, raising money for comic relief. Donate now by going to my.rednoseday.com/sponsor/Geekatorium27podcast. FUBAR and Geekatorium, doing something stupid for a very good cause.